This series deals with troubling topics including suicide, drug overdosing, and dependent adult abuse. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. Previously on The Quarterback and the Con Artist.
I kind of lost this sense of, I don't know if purpose is the right word.
At 30 years old, just 7 years into his professional football career, NFL quarterback Eric Kramer starts battling inexplicable depression.
From repeated blows to the head, as football players get, it causes this prolonged and profound brain damage.
This morning, a devastating blow to the NFL. 99% of deceased players' brains examined in a new study showed signs of CTE.
Do you blame CTE for what happened to your dad?
Yeah, I definitely think CTE is the biggest contributor by far. I don't think that he was aware of what was going on. I think he was trying his absolute hardest to figure it out, like going to a bunch of different doctors and professional help and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, obviously nothing really worked.
And on the evening of August 18th, 2015, Eric Kramer checks himself into a Los Angeles area motel, puts a gun to his head, and pulls the trigger.
The thought of him taking his life never even crossed my mind.
I'm Jonathan Walton, and this is The Quarterback and the Con Artist. Episode 2, The Pain of Being Alive.
I remember researching online, what's the best way to kill yourself?
It's May of 2015, and Eric Kramer has been quietly battling bouts of crippling depression on and off for more than 20 years.
So like Eric masked his depression.
Eric's childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
I never knew he was depressed. You didn't hear it in his voice. You didn't see it in him.
Even Chicago Bears coach Dave Wonstadt, who interacted with Eric daily for years, saw no signs that anything was wrong.
I had no inkling that he was battling depression. I had no idea. I was totally shocked, taken back. I wish I would have known, because we could have obviously helped him and assisted him, and who knows.
Though at certain times, something does seem off with Eric, especially in social settings.
Early on, sometimes he would seem a little lost in the clouds.
Eric's close friend, Robert Espinosa.
Like he'd be talking to him and he just wasn't quite focused as he normally is. He did it very well though. I had no clue. Up 2 weeks in advance, I had no idea. We had dinner like a couple months before and he seems pretty normal.
Eric manages to convince everyone that everything's fine, when in reality, that could not be further from the truth.
Just because Eric said he was okay doesn't mean he was.
That's retired NFL quarterback Eric Hipple, author of the book Real Men Do Cry. He survived his own suicide attempt and now spends his days helping students, military veterans, and former professional athletes talk about their mental health long before they ever decide to end their lives. Because once they reach that decision, they become experts at hiding their plans.
They can put on the best acting job in the world because I don't want to bother you. I don't want to, you know, be a burden to you, you know, and so I won't tell you. When it's over with, you'll feel better because I'm not around anymore.
And this is especially an issue with former athletes.
NFL players have abilities to override pain, have abilities to override the stress from the outside, pushing. You know, I can solve this myself, and I'm dedicated to getting the job done.
When a person gets to my stage, they've tried everything. And so keeping it from you is actually the goal. And so you get good at doing that. And you actually get good at, even before that, of being depressed and not letting anybody know you're depressed. Because what are they going to do?
And sadly, a lot of people who end up committing suicide usually don't tell anyone about their plans. And certainly Eric didn't. he just decided at that point that he'd had enough and he was ready to end his life.
I'm not bouncing this off of anybody, mind you, right? So this is in my mind only.
So Eric does what we all do when we want to know more about how to do something unfamiliar. He starts Googling, what's the best way to kill yourself?
And the best way was a gun under the chin. So I followed the playbook to a T. I went to a gun store in Simi Valley, had to walk around inside looking like I'm here to purchase a gun for every other reason other than suicide. And I bought a Sig Sauer 9mm gun, no understanding why it was that one, just that one.
Well, the Sig Sauer is a very popular and very foreboding firearm. Hewn black steel, thick, heavy. It's the type of gun used in the movies by the likes of James Bond and John Wick. But weeks before Eric actually decides to kill himself, his son Dylan, who's 17 at the time, notices changes in his dad that he attributes to that brain disease, CTE.
Depression, anxiety, isolation, and all that stuff that he had been, you know, doing.
Yeah.
And he had been isolating, he had been more laissez-faire, I guess, and just really just a complete shell of himself. And that was when he was at his lowest. And I think that's the sort of the tricky part about this whole CTE thing is that it has to be like those big, big events to be like, oh, that's CTE. And I think in the same breath, it's also like little stuff. Like, how do you connect with people? How do you not connect with people? Are you, you know, usually patient, and now you're sort of like you're being short and you're kind of a dick, you know, to people that you don't even fucking know and that don't know you. And
so he was very short-tempered and didn't have patience,
short-tempered.
But still, the idea that Eric was planning to take his own life never crosses anyone's mind, especially his childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
At that time, his sister and I were already planning a family trip with our kids to go to Hawaii. And I had asked him, why don't you come join us? And I can tell that he wasn't up for that. And he goes, well, I want to be able to spend some time with Dylan. I haven't seen him in over a month. So, and that was basically one of the last times I heard from him before his accident.
And the timeline of events of Eric's accident are as follows. In May of 2015, Eric Googles, what's the best way to kill yourself? And then he buys a gun. And he plans to wedge that gun up under his chin and pull the trigger to ensure a quick and certain death. It's a gruesome technique he's macabrely familiar with because it's how the warden in one of Eric's favorite movies, The Shawshank Redemption, successfully takes his own life.
Yeah, every time I've watched that movie, which is now probably in its 25, 30, 35 number of times, that particular scene I can identify with.
And as the weeks turn into months, May, then June, then July of 2015, Eric is diligently and methodically getting his affairs in order, preparing to depart this earth.
I've got to provide for a few people financially.
So he meets with lawyers, with investment bankers and estate planners, putting the millions and millions of dollars he has in cash and assets into a trust for his family and friends, which they will receive upon his death.
So I get those affairs in order. And I wrote some letters to some people, handwritten, and put them in envelopes and put them on my desk.
Eric isn't exactly sure where he wants his suicide to take place, but he knows he doesn't want to do it at home.
And I thought, though, okay, even though Dylan doesn't live here, he does have a key. And he was, I think, 17 at the time. And I'm thinking, okay, well, the last thing I want is to do this act here and have him walk in and see me in that state. That's what propelled me to think, go somewhere else.
But through all of these morbid vicissitudes, and with Eric deep in despair and far down this dark and final path, his will to live creeps up out of nowhere, and suddenly, Eric makes a last-ditch effort to save his life.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, mostly because I think dispensaries are a little overwhelming and pretentious. That's just me. You do you. But there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people can buy cannabis. You know how most dispensaries make you choose between strains with ridiculous names and you have no idea which one's for you? Well, that's what Mood.com figured out. And by the way, you can get 20% off your first order with promo code Walton. If you go to Mood.com and click Shop by Mood, it'll tell you which strain does what. Want to be more social at a party? There's a flower for that. Need to focus and get work done? There's a flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, there's a flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and arrives in a discreet box. Best of all, everything's backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code Walton. So head to Mood.com and get 20% off your first order now. In July of 2015, Eric checks himself into a depression treatment facility, hoping beyond hope that it'll fix him, that it'll change his mind and change his outlook on life. But it doesn't.
We had sort of this daily group therapy. I don't remember one day of that 30 days ever feeling like, now I feel good. Not one. There wasn't one day that I was there that I didn't wish in some way I was dead. Because the pain of being alive far outweighed anything else. And I don't care who I was talking to. I don't care, because I didn't feel a connection to anyone there. And I think the reason is, if this was a baseball game, by the time I got there, it was already the ninth inning. It was the bottom of the ninth. Two outs.
And in Eric's tortured mind, the die had been cast. So he secretly goes about preparing to end his life.
There did come a time where all of that sort of contemplation and providing and planning, there was a day where there was no longer anything left to be done. And that day, that realization that day, made me very uneasy. It was like, okay, now it's all done. If it's all done, then I am too.
So, on the evening of August 18th, 2015, Eric checks himself into the Goodnight Inn, a motel off the 101 freeway, about 5 miles from his home.
That evening, I show up, check in, and end up making a few text messages to people. One in particular went to a high school friend of mine, Chris Gurman.
But Eric has no idea. At that very moment, Chris Gurman is on a road trip nearly 2,000 miles away.
My middle son, I was checking him into his first time away going to college. He was going to Loyola New Orleans, and we had spent the day out and about buying stuff, getting everything ready. We went out to eat, checking out the town, and getting them all dialed in.
So it's a while before Chris Gurman checks his phone. And when he does, he reads Eric's final text message, and he's shocked.
Basically, he told me where he was, stated, I want you to take care of my affairs, take care of my son, and to look out after things and help out.
What did you infer from that text exactly? What did you think he was trying to say?
That he was checked into a hotel and he's going to do something to himself, or commit suicide, or attempt it. I knew exactly what that meant, so I immediately tried to call him. I'm sitting in my car with my middle son, who's, I think, 20. I was in a full panic, I ain't gonna lie.
And Chris Gurman has every reason to panic.
Please, dear God, don't make me be too late.
But he is too late. Eric had already placed that gun firmly up under his chin and pulled the trigger. Bang. A single bullet shoots out of that gun and rips through Eric's skull. There's blood everywhere. But shockingly, Eric is not dead. Not yet, anyways. He's sitting there, on that motel room bed, in a daze, bleeding profusely.
When did you know he shot himself?
So I called the hotel to see if he was checked in there, and they said he was. And they gave me his room number. I immediately called. I took my kid's phone, called the Lost Hills Sheriff Station, got back hooked up with the room, and he answered. He answered the phone. Wasn't audible. I mean, he was audible, but he wasn't really talking. He was groaning.
He didn't hear much out of me other than a little gurgling. And he said, Eric,
if you got anything in your hand, I want to hear it hit the floor right now. And I did hear something.
He heard something hit the floor.
Because in that moment, Eric drops the gun he had just shot himself with on the floor.
And he said, there are some people at your door right now.
You see, Chris Gurman, at that point in time, is a 30-year veteran detective at the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department in their Lost Hill Station, just up the road from the Goodnight Inn, where Eric is sitting on that motel room bed, dazed and confused, and quickly bleeding out.
I told him, I got people there. I need you to walk out. That door was propped open. One of the guys that I went to the academy with and worked with over there was working that night in patrol, very experienced patrol deputy. I was able to get him on another line. I had three phones going at this time. I had the ambulance there, had the patrol guy out in the field there, and had Eric on the other line. My buddy saw the hotel room that he was in. The door was propped open with towels, and the towels had blood on them.
So apparently I got up and went to the door, and from there, I don't know what happened.
And he walked out and complied completely with the deputy that was on scene, who's my friend. He saw a wound on Eric, and he's telling me this on the phone, and he's talking to Eric. Eric walked right out, and from what my buddy told me, he got onto that ambulance by himself.
I don't remember 1 second.
And so we're only piecing this together based on what people have told you. It's not because you remember it.
Mm.
You answered the phone. You stumbled to the door. Somehow you got to a hospital.
I don't know how I got to the hospital, but I think I walked down and got in the ambulance and away we went.
And this is where things get complicated. As Eric is being rushed to the hospital in that ambulance, Eric's friends and family are finding the goodbye notes he left for them, and they're freaking out. They know something tragic has happened or is about to happen, and they're feeling powerless to do anything about it.
We had no clue. We didn't know what happened other than that there were some letters left.
Anna Durgan again.
They were looking, so I start calling hospitals. At this time, we don't even know if he's at a hospital. And I think I called all hospitals in the local area.
I was actually in my backyard, just cleaning up around the yard when his sister called me.
That's Robert Espinosa, another one of Eric's good friends.
And she said that they were sending people to look for him and if I had any idea where he might have gone. So I just thought of the places we'd go hang out or places we'd go and just chill and called my two boys and had them start driving around looking, and I did the same thing.
So it sounds like you formed this impromptu search party to find him.
Yeah, anybody I knew, I started calling around, calling friends that we had to see if anyone had heard from him or spoke to him.
Or you were just driving around to all the spots you guys used to hang out and looking for him.
Just looking for him, looking for his car, seeing if he was just, you know, sitting somewhere thinking, hoping for the best and not the worst. And I felt bad too, because he called me a couple of weeks before and it was a really busy time for me.
Because at that point, Robert had just gotten married. He and his bride were moving into a new house. There were boxes everywhere. And he was super busy unpacking and trying to get settled.
He'd called and wanted to meet up for dinner and I couldn't make it. And I was like, man, I should have gone. Maybe I could have talked to him about it. Maybe he wanted to talk to me about it. I had no clue.
You felt guilty.
I felt very guilty.
So now everyone in Eric's life is calling and searching and going out of their minds looking for him. And the only person who knows Eric shot himself.
I was stressed and scared and cursing myself.
Is Chris Gurman. And he's 2,000 miles away in New Orleans in complete and utter shock.
That's a lot of emotions and a lot of fear and a lot of things going on. And I'm way on the other side of the country feeling helpless, just scrambling to see if we can get him help.
But deep down, Chris Gurman knows how this will probably play out. He's worked for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department for more than 30 years. He's seen this movie before, many times, and it never ends well.
You have this long career in law enforcement. I'm sure you've heard the story of people who shoot themselves in the head. How many survive?
The ones I've handled, none. Not a single one.
But Eric Kramer has spent a lifetime beating the odds on the field, and now, in the most important game of all, the game of life, he was down, but he was not out.
You know, it's a average age male, you know, with a self-inflicted gunshot wound and with massive facial swelling and bleeding.
Dr. Mark Kerner is on call the night Eric Kramer is brought into Northridge Hospital's emergency room.
I'm an otolaryngologist and head and neck surgeon, and I also do facial plastic and reconstructive surgery.
And when Dr. Kerner lays eyes on Eric Kramer, it doesn't look good. His head is massively swollen, beyond recognition, and he's losing a dangerous amount of blood.
And what's important is just getting bleeding under control and getting his airway established and then dealing with the other stuff later.
And what did he look like? What does a person who shoots themselves in the head and lives look like?
Well, so the entry point was under the chin, right? So under the mandible. And so what typically happens, and the reason why he survived, is because when you do that, the recoil of the gun, if you put the barrel of a handgun under your jaw, right under the front of your mandible or the jawbone, and when you pull the trigger, it recoils forward. So the recoil of the gun, then the bullet trajectory, instead of going straight back, which would potentially go in through the brainstem and probably kill him instantly, goes up through the mouth, through the nasal cavity, if you can imagine, and then up out between the eyes.
So the bullet exited where?
So it went up through between the eyes and then out sort of the top of the forehead. In front of where the optic nerves come back from our eyes that go to the brain, it was far enough forward so it missed the optic nerve. So if it was a little bit farther back, it would have nailed the optic nerves and he could have easily been blinded. So eyes were swollen shut. Nose was bleeding profusely, bleeding from the mouth and the nose profusely. And that's the reason I was called in, is that they were worried he was going to bleed to death. My goal at that point is just to stop the bleeding. So we put all kinds of what's called posterior packs, which is these special big packing, these balloons in the back of the nose to stop the bleeding. And then once we get the bleeding under control, then he needed to be taken to the operating room for the brain injury part. That gets done first, and then once I know he's surviving that and still cognizant and able to move all his extremities and hasn't stroked, then I'll go back and start reconstructing things and then letting the balloons down and dealing with the bleeding once we have the bleeding under control.
So while Eric is undergoing this emergency life-saving surgery, his friends and family still have no idea where he is or what's going on. They've called every single hospital in the area, and not one of them has an Eric Kramer listed as a patient.
When he was brought in as a John Doe.
And why was he a John Doe? I can't seem to get to the bottom of that.
We see a lot of crazy trauma at our trauma center where, especially with gunshot wounds, you never know if it's gang-related or if it's sort of a hit or what's going on. So the hospital has a policy of putting people with gunshot wounds, they put them down as a John Doe or as under an alias. And if they're high profile patients also, because we've had a number of high profile patients that have been involved in accidents or incidents, and they get put down under an alias too.
Eventually, Anna Durgan finds Eric at Northridge Hospital under the alias William Moan, and she rushes over to see him. Anna and Eric were teenagers together. They've known each other for practically their entire lives, and yet hospital staff is not allowing her in.
The nurse goes, "Who are you?" I go, "Oh, I'm his sister." And she goes, "No, you're not. I just got off the phone with her. She's in Vegas." I go, "Well, I'm kind of like a sister. I'm the family friend of the family, whatever. I'm like a sister to him."
But legally, the hospital cannot let Anna in to see Eric. It's immediate family only. So Anna pulls a fast one.
I snuck into the hospital. I had to go see him. I had to go see what he was alive, is what we were told. But we didn't know how bad it was.
How do you sneak into a hospital?
So there's different units. There's ICU, which is intensive care unit, but then there's a CCU, which is even worse, which is the critical care unit. I just snuck into the critical care unit. When someone opened the door, I walked in. Don't even ask. Don't ask. Just go. And I asked one of the people, "I'm here for Kramer," and they showed me, you know, what room he was in. So I went in. He's hooked up to all this machines and tubes and everything everywhere. But what got me was the size of his head. It was literally like the size of a watermelon. His eye was down to his cheek. Literally from here, it was down to the cheek. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I don't think he's gonna make it." That was the first thought that I had. But I just whispered in his ear, "Fight, you're a fighter, you're strong. Everybody loves you. You're going to get through this. We're here to help you. We all love you." It was shocking. It was devastating. I've never seen anything like that before.
Eric is now in a coma, in a hospital bed, hooked up to countless wires and machines. And as the days pass, doctors, nurses, and Eric's friends and family are coming to the sobering realization that he may not survive this.
Unrecognizable.
Eric's son, Dylan Kramer.
And the first thing I see is him, you know, strapped up on tubes and everything like that. And like, I didn't recognize him. Like, his head was an actual bowling ball, swollen like the fattest bowling ball you've ever seen. I mean, like, it's perfectly circle. And like, all four, it's like just a perfect circle, like a big basketball.
And what was that, just swelling?
Swelling. His fingers were sausages. I don't even know if he could have separated his fingers. It was like, you know, the next fingers meeting the next, like just big old sausages. His eyes were swollen shut. Everything about him was just so swollen. He was actually still missing the front of his skull, which once the swelling came down, it caved in. Talk about a connection between a son and a dad is I'm sitting there and the nurse had told me, like, I think he was trying to set the expectation real low. Like, don't expect like a hug, or don't expect him to react, because he was like immobile, eyes shut. Like, I didn't know if he could hear me. That's what the nurse was trying to express to me, is like, we've been trying to, you know, get some sort of reaction out of him, but just can't. I'm like, okay. So I sit down and I'm like, I just start talking to him, and right as I start talking, he hears my voice and like starts to spring out of the bed.
Oh wow.
But his hands were handcuffed.
Yeah, to, like tied down.
Everything about him was secured in. And but he tried to, you know, come and leap towards that voice that he was hearing.
So he recognized you immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I just got chills.
And the nurse was like, "Wow." And I ended up, you know, saying goodbye, and I ended up walking out. And as I got out of the room, I think before I got in the elevator, I just broke down and started crying.
Yeah, because at that point, it did not look good.
No, it looked very bad. It looked like very bad. I didn't think that. I wasn't hopeful that he was going to live.
I mean, no one was.
No.
I remember sitting there in the room talking with one of the doctors.
Eric's childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
Now it's like a week's gone by. We got to give him a feeding tube. We need permission to give him a feeding tube. Okay, go ahead. You know, just do whatever it takes to keep him alive. We had no idea how he's going to be, you know. Is he going to be able to walk, talk?
And it was pretty horrific.
Eric's other friend, Chris Gurman.
And they removed that part of his skull, and everything was kind of recessed there. He was 140 pounds and weak as can be, pale.
But Eric is alive, though he's not doing well. And while he's out of the coma and they've got him breathing on his own,
the question always is at this point is, when we save him, if we can save him, will his brain be intact?
But Eric's brain is not intact, not at all. Mentally, he seems to have regressed to infancy.
They basically said he has to learn everything again and you have to think of him like a baby.
If you or someone you know is experiencing suicidal thoughts or crisis, please reach out immediately to the Suicide Prevention Lifeline by calling or texting 988. If you're enjoying The Quarterback and the Con Artist, click that share button right now and text it to your friends and family. And if you can, leave us a 5-star review. The Quarterback and the Con Artist is produced, written, and hosted by me, Jonathan Walton, for Jonathan Walton Media. Executive producers Eric Kramer and Anna Durgan. Audio engineering by Justin Longerbeam. Editing and sound design by Zach Hirsch. Legal counsel provided by Ken Sterling from Sterling Media Law. We've got a lot of incredible stories in the works at Jonathan Walton Media, so make sure you subscribe and keep an ear out.